Boker Tov and welcome. Great to see you all this morning. Hope you are in good health. Special shout out and thank you to Mrs. Greenfield sponsoring this morning's shiur in memory of her father, Zichrono Levracha, Rabbi Cheskel Shraga ben Reb Shlomo. Shama should have an aliyah. Today we are going to appreciate, hopefully, on a new level, the world of halachic creativity and observance that we are living in right now in coronavirus. And we're going to do that through what you might call an unlikely window. The window to this appreciation is going to come from a man whose perspective on religious life is very different than ours, but will help us hopefully appreciate our perspective in a new light. This man descends from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, who we'll reference a little bit later. He was born in London, although his family is originally from Europe. He was born in 1892 in London, but grew up primarily, he was raised in Baltimore. His father was a sofer. He entered Hebrew Union College in 1911 and was ordained in 1915, a year after receiving his BA from the University of Cincinnati. And he became a faculty member at HUC. Ultimately, he settled in Pittsburgh in 1934 as the senior rabbi of the Rodef Shalom congregation. He retired in 1966, although he didn't pass away. He was retired for quite a period of time. 1990 is when he passed away. And just a special shout out for us Chicagoans, he was the rabbi of a synagogue in Chicago, of a temple in Chicago called Kehilath Anshei Ma'ariv, from 1924 to 1934. So if anybody on this Zoom remembers those days, 1924 to 1934, or remembers this rabbi, you can shout it out now. His name was Solomon Bennett Freehoff. Solomon Bennett Freehoff. That is the man, Solomon Freehoff, of blessed memory, who we will be exploring his letter to David Ben-Gurion today and appreciating our world through his perspective. Hopefully you received the email last night with the letter. And I will, you know what, I can share it on the screen now in case you don't have it. So Solomon Freehoff is a, as you could tell from the biography, he is a reform rabbi, but not just Stamazoi, a reform rabbi. He is, maybe you could argue, one of the most consequential or scholarly reform rabbis of the entire 20th century. His career as a member of the reform rabbinate was not just being a community rabbi. He was a recognized scholar, and he served on what's called the CCAR, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which was the body of the Reform Rabbinate. He was on its liturgy committee for 20 years. He was a vice president for several years. But most importantly, he was in charge of their responsa literature, as we will explain what that means. He was a scholar of the responsa literature, and he was the chair of the responsa committee for Jewish chaplains in the U.S. military, as well as the author of several works. He served briefly on the CCAR's responsa committee, but he chaired that committee initially for a little bit, but then he chaired that committee from 1955 until 1978. He published eight volumes of reform responsa, just to understand the magnitude of his impact in the reform world in the 20th century. Now, what is responsa? Responsa is a plural form of the word response, answer. It's what we call in our parlance, shilas and tshuvas, questions and answers. Practical answers to specific questions that came in a particular time and place. And so he was one of the great experts, and by the way, not just experts in the Reform world, but in general, in the history and the knowledge of responsa. So I own two volumes by Frioff, by Professor Frioff, Rabbi Frioff. One is called The Responsa, which is, this is dedicated to his father, who was a Ukrainian sofer. This is an overview of the world of responsa, of tshuvas. So it's leading respondents, selection of responsa, debates, history, modern inventions. We'll come back to this later. And then this volume, which is really interesting, if you're interested in a world that maybe you don't have so much access to because of the Hebrew barrier, especially the rabbinic Hebrew with many different halachic references, this book, also devoted to his father, is just Rabbi Frioff over the generations summarizing and translating different tshuvas from different chachamim. So it starts with Rav Shri Ragon, Rabbeinu Gershom, so Ashkenaz, Rashi, Rav Meir of Rothenburg, and the Rosh. So you're talking Balei HaTosfos, 13th century. Then he moves further. He goes to Rashba, Spain, 14th century. Marivial, Marik, Italy, North Africa, now 16th century, 18th century, Maritz Alon. Then he gets all the way to the Zakan Aaron, Rav Aaron Walkin, and Ben Zion Chai Uziel. Rav Ben Zion Chai Uziel, the chief rabbi around the time of, at the time of Rav Kook. So these are dozens of rabbis, all traditional Torah scholars, not Reform. There was no Reform in the 12th century. There was no Reform in the 17th century. And even the modern poskim he's quoting traditional poskim, and he's giving you English renditions of these tshuvas. And through these works, you can understand the perspective of the various meshivim, the various gaonim, the Talmidei Chachamim who wrote these tshuvas. You also learn a lot about the life and the time in which they lived. What were the circumstances? What were the issues that were going on? It is a tremendously rich and fascinating perspective to see how Chachamim dealt with the issues of their times, but also it shares with you a little bit about what the average Jew was thinking and feeling and dealing with, because those are the questions he's asking. So, for example, he's discussing Soldier Cohen and the Jewish dead, Menachem Mendel of Lubavitch, meaning the Tzemach Tzedek. Well, Jews were being conscripted into the Tsar's army. So now you have a new halachic question. What about a Cohen? We have a din in Shulchan Aruch, Cohen Chargas HaNefesh, a Cohen who killed someone. They're not allowed to duchen. So what's the deal in that case? Relying on Gentile chemists, a tshuva from the Maharsham, the Heilige Reb Shalom Mordechai Shvadron of Galicia. Well, now you have chemistry. How do you relate to that in the modern world? Artificial insemination from the Zakan Aaron. All of these fascinating, fascinating shilas, they are explaining to us what it was that was new and at the forefront of people's concern, who cared about halacha and the Rabbono Shalom doing what was right, be'enei Hashem. So they looked to the Enei Ha'eda, they looked to the Mori Hora, the Meshivim of that generation. They send letters, they say, Rebbe, tell us, what do we do in this case? And this is the way it's been for centuries upon centuries. So Rabbi Solomon Frioff, he was a world's expert in the tshuvas, in the responsa. And that is why David Ben-Gurion is sending him a letter to find out what does he think about our question about Mi Yehudi. So he introduces the Mi Yehudi discussion, Frioff, with a cover letter, which, let's see if I can pull it up on the screen. Here it is. Can you see it? Cover letter. It came in the email, but now you can see it on the screen. Yes! Okay. Honorable David Ben-Gurion, State of Israel Office, the Chief of State. Dear Mr. Ben-Gurion, I have your most interesting and important letter of the 27th of October 1958, indicating that you are asking a number of Jewish religious leaders in their opinions on the problem of accepting as Jews the children of a mixed marriage in which the mother is an unconverted non-Jewish. Okay, Now we know the context, so this next line makes sense to you. Since I presume you are asking me as chairman of the Responsa Committee of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, and therefore want the opinion, among others, of a liberal interpretation of Jewish law and practice in this regard, and since I am sure you know the problem is much more complicated than a mere statement of the Orthodox law would indicate, so this is going to be important, of course, it was somewhat necessary for me to make a systematic and therefore elaborate reply. Please forgive, therefore, the length of my answer, which is enclosed with best wishes. Sincerely, Solomon B. Freehoff. So this is Professor Freehoff's, Dr. Freehoff's, Rabbi Freehoff's introduction to his answer. Here it is. Response of Dr. Solomon B. Freehoff, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So he summarizes the situation, which we've talked about before, and he gives a few points which I want to address them one at a time, and they are important for reflection, even if we don't agree with him. And I think some people would take issue with the fact that we're even studying this text from a Reform rabbi, but I think that there is a tradition that we have from the Rambam of Kabbalah Sa'emes Mimisha Amaro, accept the truth from where it comes, and quite the opposite. In this case, when you see something which enables you, which is not in our, it's not consistent with our view, but enables you to clarify your own perspective, I think it's very helpful. So I'm not signing up to become a member of the CCAR. I'm not endorsing Reform Judaism. I am sharing this letter because it will help us actually understand and appreciate our tradition even more. It's my opinion. The laws involving the reception of proselytes into Judaism seem on the surface to be absolutely clear and unmistakable. However, this is not entirely the case. As in the case of other laws, also, the emotional attitude of the scholars of the various generations reflect themselves in their decisions on this question. Okay, and this is going to be very important for us to understand, especially in light of what we spoke about last week from the Urbach perspective of academic Jewish studies, keeping that in mind. So Freehoff is looking not just at what the tshuvos said, but when they were written, in what context they were written. So, when from time to time the rabbis have felt the circumstance of that they require extra cautionary prohibitions, they applied them and then became stricter. Unfortunately, these restrictive actions tend to become permanent, and the longer the law lasts, the longer do these times of restrictiveness accumulate, and the law grows further and further away from actual life. So, this is the first point that he makes, that over time there is this accumulation of strictness which takes the Torah away from life. So first of all, I would not agree with the idea that the Torah is taking further and further away from actual life. I don't think that's the case. I think, as he well knows, the halachic system is alive, and it is a living and breathing movement, and so there's constantly back and forth. At the same time, there's no question that the nature of the way that the world has developed over time and the way that the halachic system has certainly introduced many more restrictions than would have been in previous generations. I suspect that the Ribbono Shalom has, through Hashgacha, done this as a great safeguard for us. If Moshe Rabbeinu showed up in our kitchens today, he would not understand many of the chumras that we have. But I think he also wouldn't understand, but he would be shocked at the absence of spirituality that is pervasive across the world and society, and making sure that we have a halachic structure that gives us a healthy, good context in which we live, to make sure that we stay with our loyalty and fealty to the tradition, I think is very significant. So this can be viewed in different ways. The present attitude of the Orthodox rabbinate toward the reception of infant proselytes reveals this tendency toward cumulative restrictiveness. Basically, the law was generous about receiving infants into Judaism. He quotes the Gemara in Ksubis of Ger Katan Matbilin Oso Aldaz Bezdin, that you can immerse a child according to the Bezdin, even if the child is not Jewish, and they can't decide if they want to convert. Then he says, however, a century ago, a different mood came over Jewish scholars. There was an increasing amount of intermarriage, and many men asked the Jewish community to circumcise their children born of their Gentile wives, etc. So what is going on here? So Rabbi Friedhoff is quoting different tshuvas, different perspectives on whether or not we should allow ger katan matvilin also al das bezdin. We should circumcise and immerse in a mikvah a child whose mother is not Jewish, but the parents want that child to be considered Jewish. They want the child to be Jewish. So the question, this is a halakha question. So he quotes different tshuvas here. You can take a look in the article later about whether or not we should allow ger katan matbilin also al tas bezdin. So this comes up, this is a shaila even today that poskim are struggling with. Do we encourage a bezdin to immerse a child who we have a strong suspicion or a high likelihood that that child will not grow up to follow Torah and mitzvos? The reason we would immerse a child and help them become Jewish, even though they're not aware of it, because we say zachin, we say it's great for them. Yeah, is it so great to volunteer a child to a lifetime of commitment of Torah and mitzvos when they're not going to be educated about that? And they're going to be constantly violating the Torah and mitzvos that they were committed to unwittingly, unknowingly? Are we doing them any favors? So this is a question. This is one question. And it's not settled. So the first issue that he's bringing up here about the issue of these children, right? The presumption is that, first of all, they would need to be misgayer. They would need to be converted. David Ben-Gurion, right, is not proposing that we convert all of these children. So that's like part of the practical question of his response of suggesting that there is the potential for being megayer all of these children. That's one practical question which may or may not apply. But I think what needs to be addressed in the article, the line that he mentions here, which I think is very important, especially in light of our discussion last week, is that it depended on the mood of the rabbis. Is that really what is koveya? Is it really the mood of the rabbis? Or is it that there is something called elu ve'elu? In the halachic constellation of opinions, there are multiple viewpoints on any given issue, and that was by design. The Ritva, the Ritva in the Gemara, where it quotes this idea of Eilu ve'Eilu Divrei Elokim Chaim, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, who these two schools were constantly at loggerheads, arguing about almost every halachic and hashkafic issue under the sun. The Ritva quotes the basically explaining the Gemara in Erevin Daf Yud Gimel. The Ritva says, "What does it mean? Eilu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim. Both of them, these competing, contradicting views, are eilu ve'elu. How is it possible?" He says, "You know why? Because Kesha'ala Moshe Lamarim Lekabel Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu went up to get the Torah. Heralo al kol davar v'davar. Hakadosh Baruch Hu demonstrated to him on each issue 49 perspectives. Mem tespanim." 49 faces, facets, perspectives, le'iser, for restriction, and 49 perspectives, leheter. 49 perspectives that would be lenient. And this is amplified in the Maharal, in the first parak in Be'er HaGola. A few years ago, we had a whole discussion in the Sunday morning shir. If you remember, those who were with us then, when we had a whole year on Masorah, so we had an entire morning that was devoted to Eilu ve'Eilu. And so the Rebbe Shem wants it to be that there can be multiple perspectives within one halachic issue. But it's not totally, I would say, on the mood, but on the A, the learning methodology, and B, and I think this is also the consequence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving us different manhigim over different doors through the Hashgacha. And I saw in the name of the Alter Rebbe, of the Balatanya, that the perspectives in Halacha are expressions of these great Gaonim, these Mori Hora, the shorish of their neshama. That the shorish of the neshama, for example, of Beis Shammai, was an important perspective to be in the world, the perspective of austerity, of idealism, of exacting standards. And that's a type of neshama that comes into this world. It's not a question of mood. It's a question of spiritual orientation, about a methodology that is aspiring for a particular standard. As opposed to Beis Hillel, whose shorish of their neshama was more from a perspective that was, I would say, collaborative, as the way that Gemara describes it in Erevin, that Beis Hillel, they were always makdim, they always explained the words of Beis Shammai first. It was a different orientation, both in methodology and the shorish of their neshama. So it wasn't like, oh, you know, you had some rabbis who were friendly and some rabbis who were unfriendly, some rabbis who were nice and some rabbis who were mean. No, it's that the question of how do we prioritize different competing values is going to be looked at differently by different scholars, by different schools of thought, and by different spiritual perspectives. We oftentimes have competing values. Of course, Beis Shammai loved every Jew, but the competing value of loving every Jew is sometimes at odds with a value of truth or idealism or whatever conflict we're going to give. So, of course, there have been machloksin. Some of those machloksin are about interpretation, but some of that perspective about application of those interpretation depends on an overall Torah perspective, not about a personal mood. It's not that, you know, the Maharsham woke up in the morning and because he was very, you know, I don't know, he had a good cup of coffee, so he was going to be more lenient. That's not how we view it. And a person who views it that way, so they have diminished, they have sucked the entire enterprise, the entire tradition of halacha from its spiritual core. And they have reduced the rabbis to, you know, to a demeaned level. So the idea that it's about the mood, that's not the way that it is, that's not the way that it is viewed in our tradition. So now, if we go to the next page, nonetheless, I do think that kind of what we're alluding to is, if you see on the top of the next column, the fact is that Orthodox law is not objective. There is a large subjective element. Of course there's a large subjective element. There is a human and social factor in halacha. The subjectivity is not because one of the meshivim was, you know, was in a bad mood because he didn't have a good night's sleep. It's because in a particular environment, you have to understand what are the factors at play and what are the values that need to be considered. So now, one second, I see there is a comment here in the chat. He may have meant mood in the broader sense of example of the national mood. Yeah, so Paul writes, and it's, I agree with you, and I'm not scholarly enough to debate every point here. I'm just using this as a point of reflection of how we as a traditional community would see things differently than perhaps a reform. Maybe he meant it in that way. But that's how I understood it, and that's why I think it's important for us to be aware for ourselves, because it really relates to what we mentioned last week about academic Jewish studies, of how do we understand looking at the substance of the arguments and not getting caught up in saying, well, the reason the Rambam wrote this was because his father died when he was, you know, X years old. We are interested in the content, the intellectual content that is being transmitted in these tshuvas, and understanding that part of that content is taking into consideration the human and social factor and the milieu in which it is given. Sometimes, by the way, just parenthetically, sometimes actually it's important to note that the tshuvas that you're reading, the responsa, which is the theme of this morning, that sometimes is actually limited in the application, because many times there are factors that apply in a particular case that cannot be replaced or extrapolated from in a different context. So Rav Schechter Shlita, who we'll talk about in a little bit, when he was asked after the passing of Rav David Feinstein, Zichrono Levracha, this past year, Rav David Zichrono Levracha passed away, Rav Schechter would consult with him on various halachic questions. So someone asked Rav Schechter, why did he consult specifically with Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, about halachic questions? So he said, you know why? Because many of Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvos, Rav Schechter explained, were written in a specific context to a specific person in a specific scenario, and it's not necessarily known what other variables might have been at play. And he says that Rav David Feinstein was very close to his father, and he knew many of these cases. So Rav Schechter would call him or meet with him to discuss what were the other variables to understand better what Rav Moshe was getting at in that tshuva. So now, let's go a little weiter here. There is a large subjective element, although with regard to a child of a Gentile mother, even though the Shulchan Aruch implies that he should be circumcised, that, but merely he should be not be circumcised on the Shabbos. Nevertheless, if the rabbis feel it necessary to be strict, they'll rely on what it says in Shulchan Aruch Yoredeah, where Israelis Ramos says that in the case of a man under the ban on Cherem, the court may refuse. So there are different approaches. Okay. It is clear then that the law is not absolutely firm, fixed. If the rabbis today felt it proper to be liberal, they would encourage rather than fear the reception of these children as Jews. They would, of course, ask for the ceremonial requirements, but their attitude would be friendly and not hostile to the entire situation. So first of all, to project that the rabbis are hostile to this situation, I'm not sure that that's an accurate projection. I don't think it's hostility. And to make it seem as though these are ceremonial requirements and they're not a big deal, that's exactly the point. For Orthodox rabbis, this is a big deal, because it's not just a ceremonial act. It is committing a child to a life of Torah and mitzvos. So he seems to be conflating two things here, right? He's throwing in the ceremonial issue as an aside, even though that was the bulk of his argument until now. We can have a discussion halachically whether you apply ger katan in this case or not. That's one question. The rabbis were not asked if we should apply ger katan. That's not what Ben-Gurion wrote in his letter. The question is, how should we register these children? Okay. So now, I want to focus now on the next paragraph, because I think this is really the core of what we need to focus on for ourselves as engaged, committed halachic Jews. In this regard, it is important to note the decision of the CCAR, which is the official organization of the Reform movement in America. Such a child is welcome to enter the school of a Reform congregation, and if the child completes the school courses, we consider this education, here's the key line, to be the full equivalent of any ritual ceremonial of conversion. In other words, in Reform, while the ceremonials are not disregarded, the education in ethics and in Jewish history and literature is considered the more important element. This is also why, in our reception of converts, we are not merely content with the ceremonies, but take a month or more in instruction. So far be it for us, Rachmana Litzlan, to throw stones at others, and to critique, and to diminish. But this is a key line that we need to take stock of. We need to think about this. I don't know anything about Pew Research. I don't know anything about what's going on out there beyond our Dal and Amos learning together here in Chicago. But lo aleinu, rachmana litzlan, what do we hear? What do we hear is the fate of Jews out there who were raised in an environment where commitment to observance to the Maisa HaMitzvah, which has kept us for Dore Doros through the generations. Yes, not looking exactly the same, but through this process, the halachic process. Now we see what happens, lo aleinu, when you substitute commitment and action with education and history. Values. Values alone are not enough. Some of you remember we spoke about this a little bit in Dr. Belkin's Zecher Tzadik Levracha's introduction to his book, I think it was called In His Image, where Dr. Belkin points out that Judaism, the Torah, is not a system of theology. The Torah doesn't give you values. The Torah gives you actions, because through actions you maintain and you nurture and you pass on to future generations those values. But without a system of actions, without a commitment to a particular lifestyle, then everything else is just going to fall away. So lo aleinu, that choice by Reform Jews to substitute commitment and maisa mitzvah and observance with education and values, where has it left us? Rachmana litzlan, we should be crying. We're not deriding, we're bemoaning, and we're crying. And we need to realize for ourselves, we need to take a step back and say, you know what, Taka, what does our community look like? How committed are we to our Maisa HaMitzvah, to everything that it says in the Shulchan Aruch, to this world of Halacha? Because we see what the alternative is. And even, I find it shocking, that a man whose life was devoted to the highest levels of remarkably accomplished scholarship will say that a month of study about Judaism is sufficient to be construed as Kabbalah's or mitzvahs as transformational, that person should be considered to be Jewish, that should replace conversion, a month or more of instruction. I find it merapsin ikra. I find it unbelievable, hard to understand. And now we can appreciate why it is that Bati Din, like the RCA and the CRC and others, when conversion is taken by a person, by the, they have special Bati Din Legir, when it's taken under consideration, it's months and years of study and understanding and getting to know the individual and their circumstance and their motivation. You know, Chazal, they have mixed feelings about Gerim. There are different perspectives, and it's not time today, and we should make sure to emphasize when we talk about this whole conversation about converts, the mitzvah v'ahavtem es hager, to make sure that Gerim, when they enter our community, they feel loved and accepted and welcome and at home. But it's a serious process. I just don't understand how someone of such substantive scholarship would say that a month or so of instruction is sufficient. It's hard to understand. He then goes on, and you could read the rest on your own, of his suggestion that we can construct two different models. Of course, they can't be, a child can't be registered as a Jew if they didn't undergo some conversion process. And to that, he's mode. So it's either got to be, you know, the ceremonial religious rites, or it's got to be the education. It's got to be something. So he suggests maybe for someone who undergoes conversion according to Reform standards, we would call them a convert, a ger tzedek. And somebody who doesn't, who wants to sign themselves up as Jewish, they could be called a ger toshav. Ger toshav. And this is an interesting discussion in the Rambam about what qualifies a ger toshav. And he acknowledges, he quotes the Rambam without going into the complex situations of it, even though the context of ger toshav was limited after the Jewish state. But maybe we can resurrect it. And he says, what we should do is the state of Israel should say, this person is a ger toshav, and then when they want to get married, they're going to go to the religious authorities, who will then have to deal with the fact that they're not actually fully Jewish, they're only registered as Jewish. So this is not the only person who makes this suggestion, but this was the suggestion that last week Professor Urbach said was going to be a disaster. Is this child growing up, does he know what it means, ger toshav? Does he know that he's going to have to actually do conversion, that when he gets to the rabbinate to marry him off or her off, they're going to tell him they're not really Jewish? So then there are the practical difficulties with this, which of course never materialized. But I think this discussion by Professor Freehoff, by Dr. Freehoff, it reminds us about the importance of living the halachic process and our commitments to religious observance, and it should make us be not gaiva in an unhealthy sense, but we should be self-aware and proud, gaiva to kedusha, of what's going on in the Orthodox community right now during COVID. And let me explain what I mean. I mentioned earlier this overview about the response of Dr. Freehoff, and in the end of the book, after he has, chapter 7 is about curious responsa, interesting shilas like including a robot, a golem, and a minion, or taking thumbprints on Shabbos. What about a hypnotized shochet? There are all kinds of things in the tshuvas, because you know there are tens of thousands of tshuvas. So there are a lot of, you know, once in a while you'll find something very interesting. But in the end, in chapter 8, and in light of what we just read, it's really interesting. He has a chapter called Prospective Development of the Responsa Literature. Where is the world of tshuvas going? Where's it going? This book is written in 1955. That's, I don't know how many years ago it is. We're in 2021 now, so we got to add the math a little bit. We got to add the sixth. Prospective development of responsa. So he talks about the creation of responsa. The creation of responsa. One second, there's a comment here. In the post-World War II era, in the hinterlands, like in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with one or two Shomer Mitzvahs Jews before the rise of the day school in Chabad, this was the norm. Lo aleinu, until the 1980s or beyond, we knew children raised and educated in the Reform movement as Jews, only to find out later that they were never converted when they want to marry. And I'm sure that was very traumatic for them and very difficult. Anyway, so he's giving you the history here of the development of responses. So here is a fascinating line. Ready for this? Quote, "The vigor of the responsal literature depends primarily upon the vitality of Jewish religious life. As long as observant Jewish life continues substantially as it has for centuries, and the people adhere to the inherited laws and customs, then the varied circumstances of a widespread religious society are bound to produce a constant stream of questions. But as soon as religious life retreats from a certain field of experience, that field immediately disappears from practical religious law, and therefore from the responsal literature. A listing of the types of questions asked and answered in any generation or any land would reveal which field in Jewish law or ritual was the most intensely cultivated in that time and place. Likewise, if we notice the fields in which fewer and fewer questions are asked, we can learn ex silentio where Jewish observance is fading away." I don't know what it's like in the Reform and conservative communities. Halavai, hopefully, they have tremendous, vibrant Torah activity in the realm of Tshuvas. Halavai. I don't know. I can't speak to that. I don't know what Dr. Freehoff would say about the vibrancy and the questions that people are asking. I don't know. I'm not part of that community. But what I do know is that in our Torah community, which is not perfect, but has a lot to learn from people like Dr. Freehoff, it's not perfect, and we do have a lot to learn. We have so much to be proud of. And Corona, this terrible machala, this pandemic, lo aleinu Hashem should send us a refuah to Yeshua, mamish today. Do you know what it has generated? It has generated a renewed interest in the world of tshuvas and the world of responsa, because it has precipitated incredible halachic creativity among the great Mori Hora, the poskim of our generation, and it has brought that world, the world of tshuvas, out to the public square. Now more average everyday people are aware of the concept of a shaila and a tshuva. They're aware of the process of psak, that sometimes they'll ask their local Orthodox rabbi, but the rabbi won't know what to do, so the rabbi will pass it along to someone who's greater. And so now we, the average everyday Jew, are embracing responsa and have access to responsa like never before. Imagine you were living in the 13th or 14th century. How many of you would have access to the Rashba, Reb Shlomo ben Aderet of Barcelona? How many of you would have access to his tshuvas, to his letters, what he was writing, what people were asking? You wouldn't have that. But now you can go online and you can get access and learn the tshuvas of Rav Asher Weiss about dealing with Corona, the tshuvas of Rav Yatz, Rav Rimon, about what to do about Corona, the tshuvas of Rav Shecht. I'm going to share with you now. You can get this on Torah Web. Take a look on my screen. This is what they call Piskei Corona from Rav Shechter. Piskei Corona. Look at these shailas. So this is a collection of letters of responsa. These are tshuvas on all areas of life that you, each one of us, you've seen this. You've heard these tshuvas. Some of you have read them. You can download them. This PDF that I have here, I'm happy to share it with you afterwards. It's 107 pages long. But look what the kinds of shailas are. These are all Rav Shechter's tshuvas. I'll show you before we go through the tshuvas. Take a look here at the... This is a copy of a tshuva. You see Rav Shechter's heading. Many of these tshuvas you see here are in Hebrew and then signed. And some of them are also translated into English. This is how you can ask him a shaila. So look at these tshuvas. These are ones you've maybe asked yourself. Tvilas kelim when the mikveh is closed. Kashering a dishwasher. Tanis bechorim. What do we do about tanis bechorim? Can we make a siyum on Zoom? Does a siyum on Zoom work for tanis bechorim? These tshuvas are only corona tshuvas. We didn't have these tshuvas last year, or 2 years ago, or 5 years ago. Saying kol dichvin at the Seder. What do we say at the Seder? Anybody who's hungry can come and eat. But if we're in quarantine this year, this past year, we couldn't say. So can you actually say that? Let's go beyond Pesach. Let's go weiter. Kriyas HaTorah. What about Kriyas HaTorah when you have only a Zoom minion? Tziruf to a minion. This was big. How many of you saw pictures of people in Israel who are on different balconies in different mirpasot? Mirpasot, right? Can you count them for a minion? So yeah, it was one kind of shiloh when the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan debated it. Now it's Lamaisa. And our mirpasot are different than, let's say, the backyards here in Timber Ridge. Maybe we have to look differently in Devonshire, Chveis. These are tshuvas. This is the world that we're living in. Pikuach nefesh. What about really reaching out to somebody who is in isolation? Taras mishpacha. What about showering after the mikvah? We know there's a practice in Yeridea for a woman doesn't use the shower, wash off based on a tradition, an old minug, but she's worried. Maybe she's concerned that she's exposed to the virus in the mikvah. She wants to wash afterwards. Weddings without a minyan. Simchas on Zoom. How about dealing with a tahara? Temporary burial. Unfortunately, there were cases over the course of Corona and Lo Aleinu, it shouldn't be anymore, where people, I know even in Chicago, were buried here temporarily, al das, that they should be reinterred in Israel afterwards. Erev Tavshilin, Bein HaMetzarim, washing your hands on Tisha B'Av, Sukkos, tons and tons of examples. We can go on and on. We could have many shiurim. So many of these issues have been talked about. But why do I bring it up now? Because what does Professor Frioff explain to us? He says that the vigor of the response literature depends on the vitality of Jewish life. And he said the opposite. That we can gauge the vitality of Jewish life by looking at the response literature. We could see that our community, Baruch Hashem, is alive and it cares and it's committed. And that's inspiring. That to me is incredibly inspiring. Corona has brought out many, many aspects of greatness in Klal Yisrael as a whole and as an individual's befrat. And I think this is one of those elements of greatness. Greatness is to see how so many people, despite the difficulties, have embraced and committed themselves to doing their utmost, that these tshuvas, which many of them contain many leniencies, but these leniencies really reflect astringency and aspiration. We're living in an aspirational community who wants to follow the Dvar Hashem, who wants to be connected. So if that means we have to do all kinds of things within the halachic context, not to replace observance with education, to support it with education, to infuse it with meaning with education, but to make sure that we are firmly and totally committed to all those practices, l'dore doros, that's what's happening. So people have to learn. The more people have to get involved in understanding and reading the tshuvas and knowing what's going on. So that gives us such a greater appreciation. It's amazing. It's amazing that people care, Baruch Hashem, how much pride we have in that. And it's amazing that Baruch Hashem, we have Talmidei Chachamim who are able to, with their encyclopedic knowledge and their understanding of the human condition and the individual, to answer those shilas. So we read Dr. Frioff and we say, ah, this is a man who, he reminds us to be committed in our way to Jewish observance, to explore the world of responsa literature. And I'm happy to share these tshuvas from Rav Schechter and others if you'd like. Just send me an email afterwards. But it also gives us a sense of pride. And to see Baruch Hashem how committed we are as a community, and to nurture that and to inspire us to continue to follow down this path. And I think it's so timely. It's so amazing how, on the one hand, this rabbinic luminary, this genius, I mean, he accomplished so much, Professor Frioff, who died in 1990, was so prescient to be able to make us see, to help us appreciate what it is that we have as a Torah community and what we are committed to. Ki heim chayenu v'orech yameinu. The halacha is the way of life. That is our life. And we're not going to give that up. Even people who, God forbid, maybe they've gotten lost, whatever, it doesn't matter. We can always welcome them back. And the contours of our community is this commitment to halacha. Somebody wrote in the chat, what's my email again? Our brand at torahchicago.org. Have a great week. Shavua Tov. Thanks for coming.